Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Vicki Mazzone. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, from championing society's invisible victims to exploring and creating new roads. Politics impact our daily lives. On today's show, new contributor M.L. Laurie shares her thoughts about our place in the world and how we perceive it. Kristen Thiel presents us with two women who explored the big picture in life with different approaches. But first, Tavi Fashi Drake and Brian Delaney delve into the origins of gazpacho with their guest, Antonio Diaz.
Like a fruiting vegetable, we humans bloom when ready and defy strict classification.
I like it.
Gazpacho.
Olé!
Originating in the southern Spanish region of Andalusia, gazpacho is a cold soup made of raw vegetables, bread, garlic, olive oil, salt, and vinegar. Gazpacho is widely eaten in Spain and neighboring Portugal, particularly during the hot summer months, as it is refreshing and cool. Some people like to call it liquid salad.
Ingredients, texture, and how thick the gazpacho is made vary regionally and between families. There are many modern variations of gazpacho, often in different colors such as red, white, and green, depending on ingredients. Gazpacho may be served as a starter, main dish, or as a tapa, slightly chilled but not iced, and with a variety of side garnishes such as hard-boiled eggs, chopped ham, slivered almonds, cumin crushed with mint, or oranges, to name a few.
Antonio Diaz is a celebrity hairdresser working in print, advertising, and television, based in New York City, but born in Spain, the birthplace of gazpacho. Hola, Antonio. Welcome to our show.
Hola, Antonio.
Hi, how are you doing, guys?
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure.
Speaking of Spanish, can you translate welcome to peace, love, and soup into Spanish for us?
Yeah.
Bienvenidos a paz, amor y sopa.
Paz, amor y sopa.
That sounds pretty good.
You know, when Tavi and I decided, hey, let's do gazpacho this month, you were the first person that popped into my head.
Yes.
So tell me about growing up with gazpacho, your heritage, your culture.
I was born in Granada, moved to Barcelona when I was 11 years old. Where I grew up, it was like 60s, and we were going for 3 decades already of the Franco dictatorship. Spain was pretty much behind in technology, and we didn't even have at the time a fridge. So it was like a cold room. Then they delivered some ice a couple of times a week. And one of the oldest memories I might have is when I was a child, and my grandmother was the expert in gazpacho. In the summer, from the time the tomatoes, they were start being fresh, anytime you were hungry or you needed some comfort food, it was always gazpacho in the kitchen.
It's interesting to hear gazpacho being called a comfort food, because I guess with it being chilled, I don't think of it as being comforting.
Yeah, I mean, here in the States, the way we see it is like a cold, light soup. But the ingredients, my grandma used to put bread on it and toasted almonds. And for that, you needed to really blend it very well. So it became like thicker and much more heavier than the tomato soup we normally have here.
So we were also reading about green gazpacho, but really the tomato gazpacho, like that is the gazpacho of Spain.
That is, yeah. The gazpacho we're talking is the classic one with the tomatoes. It's what we call gazpacho andaluz. It's from Andalusia.
And how do you say it?
Andalusia.
When I was in, I think it was high school or just after college, and I went to Spain for my first time, I believe I ordered gazpacho in a bar, like walk up and get a glass and drink it and leave. It wasn't like a restaurant sit-down experience. Is that still the case? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the south, there is gazpacho and some of them, even salmorejo, which is just like another layer of gazpacho. And it's much more basic. It's just tomato and garlic, a little bit of onion and bread. And then you can chop Iberian ham and boiled eggs, and you cut it in cubes, and that is the garnishing that you just put on top of it.
Oh.
Then they have it in any bar in the south.
So that's probably what I was ordering, the
salmorejo?
Salmorejo.
Would gazpacho be chunkier?
It could, but my grandma's, it was always very creamy. And if you didn't blend it that much, it will get chunkier, and sometimes it not so pleasant for the throat.
Oh, so to clarify, when you're saying creamy, there was not dairy added to it?
No, it's amazing. It's the almonds and the bread, actually. You can, as a garnishing, you use all the ingredients like the cucumber, the pepper, and you cut all that in little cubes, and then you garnish it on top of it with a little drizzle of olive oil, and that's it.
It's making me hungry just hearing about it, actually.
I think we should try to make his grandmother's gazpacho.
Yeah, we want to have your gazpacho recipe.
And tell us, how do we gay it up? Because it's gazpacho.
Yes. How do we give gazpacho the pride it deserves?
And I will add a cup of love and kisses.
Oh.
What a romantic he is.
Oh, my goodness. I'm blushing, actually. I'm as red as a tomato. What we could do is take a rainbow of colors of vegetables, diced fine, and make a little rainbow on top of our bowl of soup as a garnish.
We know how to do that.
Do you know about the Tomatina Festival in Buñuel, Spain?
Buñuel, yeah. I've never been there, but the images I've seen in videos, sometimes it feels fun and sometimes it feels very gross. I mean, people there are totally covered in tomatoes and it's just like people rolling around the tomatoes. It's like, I don't know. It's like pretty crazy.
Yeah, I saw one of the videos and it was a huge dump truck with a top off. And then they were just throwing mounds of tomatoes at the crowds and they're getting tossed on and then they're tossing back.
Totally a tomato soup town.
We read that there were over 300,000 pounds of tomatoes being thrown at that festival.
Imagine cleaning that up.
Nope.
So this tomato festival, that's in Buñuel?
Buñuel, yeah.
Well, it reminded me of Louis Buñuel, who is one of my favorite surrealist filmmakers from Spain.
Yeah, pretty much he's the one who put Spanish cinema in the map, you know. The image I have is just sharp knife just cutting the eyes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's one of the first pieces of early cinema, and it is. It's a Dali and Buñuel collaboration. That image of the moon with a cloud going across it, and then it cuts to this eye with a razor going through it.
Yes, yes.
Speaking about Spanish cinema, what about Pedro Almodovar? Are you a fan?
I mean, I'm totally a fan, and actually, at the time that they were filming Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, I was starting my career, so I did assist in that film as a hair assistant. And I remember I was in the army, so in my time free, I was assisting one of these hairdressers. And so I was on the set, and it was pretty amazing what a talented man he is.
Oh my God.
I don't even
know
where to begin with the questions.
That's incredible. Yeah.
At that time, I didn't even know Pedro Almodovar.
Have you seen him since?
Yeah, I've seen him a couple of times, yeah.
So do you put barbiturates in your gazpacho?
No,
like Pedro did?
No comment. At least my grandma did it.
And tell me about Antonio Banderas. I had such a crush on him in his younger days.
I mean, who didn't?
No, I never met Antonio, unfortunately.
Oh, All right, whatever.
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Antonio Banderas should be so lucky to meet Antonio Diaz.
Hello.
That's what I think. And so you were in the army and moonlighting as a hairdresser, and that's how you got your start in hairdressing.
Oh, no, my hairdresser story started much earlier.
You're going to have to tell me about how you became a hairdresser.
Well, the first story that it came to my mind, I was probably 6.5, 7 years old, and I was pretty much collecting the Elnett empty hairspray from my mom and the broken doll from my sister, and I just went through some rooms in the back of where we were living, and I created my first and my only hair salon. I had an uncle, and he was a barber, so I remember when I went to the hair salon to get my hair done, I was just hiding and collecting whatever hair I could. The dolls, they didn't have hairs, they were bald, so I just took like corn threads or cut hair or whatever, got closer to hair, and I glued it to the head. It was very creative at that time.
Were your parents accepting of this?
No way to say. Pretty much I got punished for that.
But you persisted.
Yes.
And when did you come to New York?
27 years ago.
And it takes you around the world.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's amazing. That is what I would encourage young people. Whatever dream you have, just Go for it. Don't be afraid, even if you're not accepted or your family doesn't accept it. Don't let anyone stop you in any sense. Work hard and believe in it and make it happen.
That's so beautiful. Antonio, it was a real treat to get to talk to you today about all sorts of things Spanish.
Good luck with this amazing adventure you started it. I'm very proud of my man.
Oh, my darling. Well, thank you so much.
I had a great time.
Wonderful.
Gracias, gracias. And happy gay pride.
Muchas gracias por escuchar y estar con his love and soup.
Fruit versus vegetable.
Botanically, a tomato is a fruit, a berry.
It is the ovary together with its seeds of a flowering plant. It is less sweet than other fruits because of its lower sugar content.
Typically served in a salad or as the main course of a meal rather than at dessert, it is, in the U.S., considered a culinary vegetable. Tomatoes are not the only food with this ambiguity.
Bell peppers, cucumbers, green beans, eggplants, avocados, and even squashes of all kinds, such as zucchini and pumpkins, are all botanically fruits yet cooked as vegetables. This has led to legal dispute in the United States. In 1887, U.S. tariff laws that imposed a duty on vegetables but not on fruits caused the tomato status to become a matter of legal importance.
A Supreme Court settled this controversy in 1893 by declaring that the tomato is indeed a vegetable, based on the popular definition that vegetables are served with dinner and not dessert. Nutrition. A medium tomato has 20 calories and contains 40% of the daily recommended value of vitamin C, 20% vitamin A, and 6% of fiber.
Even better for you than citrus.
Tomatoes contain lycopene, which is a natural antioxidant that works effectively to slow the growth of cancer cells. Cooked tomatoes produce even more lycopene, so go ahead and cook up a batch of tomato soup.
And if you have cast iron, cook them in that, because then you'll actually be pulling more of the iron out of your pan.
Didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
We might also add that our bodies absorb significantly more lycopene when eaten with a fat. Drizzle it with olive oil.
Or add some almonds to your gazpacho.
Or eat it with a sliced avocado.
Who doesn't love the excuse to have more fat in their diet?
Yeah. And FYI, there is twice the amount of nutrition in a homegrown vine-ripened tomato versus commercially matured green gas-ripened ones.
So grow them in a pot, in the ground, or buy fresh from your local farmer's market. There's a variety for all tastes.
To learn more about gazpacho, visit the Peace, Love, and Soup page on KBOO's website. Go to KBOO-FM and search for Peace, Love, and Soup. Now, Tavi and Brian present some fun facts about the tomato, including its link to werewolves.
Tomatoes.
Tomatoes grew wild in Central and South America and were mostly yellow and cherry-like in size, rather than the red larger ones we know today. They spread throughout the world following the Spanish colonization of the Americas in the 1500s. From Latin America, the Spanish took tomatoes to the Philippines, and from there they were introduced to Asia, and then back to Europe, where they easily grew in the Spanish Mediterranean climate.
Fun fact, it would be 100 years still until tomatoes spread to southern Italy, where they were called pomodoro, or apple of gold. In fact, Italians first grew them as ornamentals in flower beds long before they began eating them.
Its scientific specific name, Lycopersica, means wolf peach and comes from the German werewolf myths. Upon the tomato's arrival in Western Europe, legends said that this deadly nightshade was used by witches and sorcerers in potions to transform themselves into werewolves. Due to these myths, the rest of Western Europe believed tomatoes to be poisonous, and they were very suspicious of this bright and shiny fruit far into the mid-1800s.
Fun fact, the leaves, stem, and green unripe fruit of the tomato plant are in fact slightly poisonous. They contain a small amount of the toxic alkaloid tomatine, only dangerous to humans if consumed in large amounts, but very toxic to dogs should they chew the plant material.
I did not know this before, and I am a dog owner. The world-traveling tomato finally made its debut in the young country of the United States in the mid to late 1700s. Coming by way of the Caribbean, tomatoes were first cultivated in South Carolina, while simultaneously being introduced in California and parts of the Southwest through the Spanish missions.
Fun fact, Thomas Jefferson ate tomatoes in Paris, Paris.
Maybe.
And sent seeds back home, where he eventually grew them in his own garden at Monticello.
Extra fun facts.
Tave, did you know that tomatoes have been designated the state vegetable of New Jersey and the official fruit of Ohio?
Brian, that is nothing because Arkansas declared the South Arkansas vine ripe pink tomato to be both the state fruit and the state vegetable, citing both its culinary and botanical classifications.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, recent studies by plant geneticists show that tomatoes have 31,760 genes.
That's 25% more than humans have.
How many do they have?
Humans only have 24,000 genes.
Time now for the She-Ra Solution with Kristen Thiel. It is a monthly biography of women past and present that was inspired by Maria Teresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl. On today's segment, Kristen presents two women, a trailblazing motorcycle daredevil who didn't worry about the details, and the mother of forensic science who was all about the details.
I connect the women in these She-Ra Solution segments in various ways, sometimes by their field, sometimes by where or when they lived. This month, I'm interested in how two very different women broke the traditional gender constraints of the 1940s and 1950s in two very different ways. It's easy to think of women who lived at that time as wives, mothers, homemakers, maybe as stepping in to fill a work role during the war, maybe. But nothing about Bessie B. Stringfield's life was stereotypical. Even her background is a blend of fact and fiction, making for one dizzying tale about a girl and her hog. According to Bessie, she was born in Jamaica to an interracial couple. Her mother died when she was young, and her father moved them to Boston, where he promptly abandoned his daughter. An Irish Catholic woman adopted Bessie and gave her a motorcycle when she was 16 years old. It was a 1928 Indian Scout. However, also according to Bessie, she was born in Massachusetts. And maybe she was born around 1918. But biography websites have her born in February 1911. Her death certificate says she was born March 1911. The Social Security Index says she was born in March 1912. According to Bessie's niece, she was born to Maggie Cherry and James White, two African Americans who had never been to Jamaica or Massachusetts and instead lived in North Carolina. But hold up, let's get back to what is true and what really matters. Bessie was a top-notch motorcycle rider at a time when women did not ride freely, especially not African-American women. Bessie's niece and nephews told the New York Times earlier this year that Bessie would come roaring into Baltimore, where they lived with their mother, Bessie's older sister. One nephew remembered, quote, "She would stand up on that bike with one foot on the seat and one foot on the handlebars." Such daredevil antics drove her from the family's good graces, and she stopped coming around. Bessie switched to Harley Davidson's early on and fell in love with the brand. She had 27 Harleys over her lifetime. She would toss a penny on a map and ride where it landed. In doing so, she completed 8 solo trips across the United States, including riding through the Deep South, risking her life. Unwelcome in most motels, across the country, not just the South, Bessie stayed with African-American families or slept under the stars. And in the process, she became the first African-American woman to ride a motorcycle in every one of the contiguous 48 states. In addition to risking her life in a racist society, Bessie risked her safety simply because of primitive road conditions. These rides happened before many roads were paved. The idea of an American interstate highway system didn't even come into being until 1956. When, not if, Bessie's bikes broke down, she was going to have to be her own mechanic. Bessie made money in a variety of ways, but always with her bike. During World War II, she worked for the Army as a civilian motorcycle courier in the United States. She also performed stunts at fairs and carnivals, including riding the Wall of Death, in which motorcyclists zoom sideways and upside down along a bowl-shaped arena. Bessie settled in Miami, Florida in the 1950s, first working as a maid and later becoming a certified nursing assistant. When necessary, she picked up the children of the family she worked for from school, on her Harley, wearing a leather jacket. She had no children of her own who survived past infancy. She and her first husband of six, suffered the loss of three babies. Stringfield was Bessie's third husband's last name. She kept it at his request because he liked that she had made the name famous. While in Miami, Bessie founded the Iron Horse Motorcycle Club. She won races, but often was denied the titles when officials realized she was a woman. She did get to keep the nickname she earned performing stunts around the city like she'd done with her niece and nephews. That nickname was Motorcycle Queen of Miami. The American Motorcyclist Association included Bessie in its inaugural exhibit at the Motorcycle Heritage Museum in 1990. 3 years later, Bessie died, around age 82. But her legend obviously lived on. The American Motorcyclist Association began giving the Bessie Stringfield Award to leading female motorcyclists. And in 2002, she was inducted posthumously into the Motorcycle Hall of Fame. And this year is the 5th annual Penny Tour, an all-female ride celebrating Bessie and named for the way she chose her destinations. While Bessie was wowing the crowds and writing her own legend, elsewhere in the country, Frances Glessner Lee was birthing her own unique contributions. Called the Mother of Forensic Science, Frances founded the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard University and served as the United States' first female police captain. Inspired by a childhood in Chicago, spent both reading Sherlock Holmes and building miniature models, young adult Frances used her family fortune in the 1940s to create Harvard's newest department. There, she taught student investigators how not to contaminate a crime scene, and how not to mishandle evidence, and how to determine cause of death. She did so with her nutshell studies of unexplained death. These nutshells were dollhouse-sized dioramas of actual murders, suicides, and accidental deaths. They are remarkable for three big reasons. They revolutionized the brand new field of homicide investigation. Before them, few people had any good training in crime scene investigation. And they are so well done that they are still used in trainings at the office of the chief medical examiner in Baltimore. They are also accurate, down to the tiniest of details. Frances knit the teeny socks of victims with straight pins. She rolled and burned to exact length mini cigarettes that were filled with actual tobacco. She wrote letters with one hair plucked from a toothbrush. And all the windows and doors in the nutshells had working locks. When you look at these dioramas today, you can't help but think how subversive Frances was being, using the, quote, women's work of crafting to instruct investigators, most of them men, in studying death. Finally, and perhaps most fascinating of all, were the crimes that Frances chose to showcase with her nutshells. Frances was known to champion society's, quote, invisible victims. Anyone whose cases might be tainted by investigator prejudice. For example, the deaths of women, people who were poor, others living on the fringe of society often weren't treated as seriously or thoughtfully as others. But that's who Frances showed in her miniature crime scenes. She wanted students to learn not just about properly handling a crime scene, but about recognizing their own biases toward the humans involved and practicing treating everyone with equal care and respect. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel. I'll be back next month.
New contributor ML Laurie shares some thoughts about our internal processes, what we learn, and how it's a good idea to stop for a minute and think about our decisions. Here's ML Laurie with a new segment entitled Stop for a Minute.
So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about this. All living beings are classified into different categories. We are classified as Homo sapiens, human beings. When we are born, we are all born as human beings. We are undeveloped, dependent, and our focus is on comfort, warmth, not being hungry and being clean. We cry to make our needs known because we don't know words. Yes, we are all unique. No two humans are exactly the same. Even identical twins have different fingerprints and definitely different brains from which they perceive things. But we all share being human first, from birth. So other than the biological makeup we are born with, what makes us different? Let's think about this. When we are born, we are functioning from our basic body makeup made up of our body parts and the brain which tells it all how to work. So think about this. If we use the analogy of a computer, our basic body makeup is like a computer hard drive. Our hard drive is made up of all our body parts, including the brain, which makes it all work. So, since we all have the same kind of human body or basic hard drive to make us work, what makes us so different? Think about this. As we grow and interact with the world, we are taught many things about who we are, like we are smart, dumb, etc. Also, we are taught who our family is, what our culture is and what that means, and our parents' thoughts about the world and people. We are taught what to think about ourselves and the world, and we make our decisions about what we are taught through an undeveloped child's mind. So these things we are taught are like the software programs on a computer. We have our hard drive, our human body, and then we are taught things that are placed on our hard drive like software programs on a computer. We then operate, perceive our world, and live our lives based on these learned software programs. So let's stop for a minute and think about all of this. What makes us different? Are we really only different because of the different software programs we have had put on our hard drive since we were born? Bottom line, are all our differences just taught to us, learned? Yes. This is reality. This is what makes us different. It is all learned, and we perceive all from what we have learned to be the truth. So think about this. Is it possible some of our software programs, our learned ways of thinking, are faulty, mistaken, or just simply wrong? Is it possible that since we are all human beings first, that we are not really so different? After all, we are all experiencing our human condition. So think about this. Which of your software programs cause you to feel happy, and which ones cause you to feel unhappy? Stop for a minute. Think about all of this. Think about it. I'm ML Laurie.
Well, that is all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests and our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Tavi Fashi-Drake, Brian Delaney, Antonio Diaz, and ML Laurie. Also, thanks to our technical editor, Derek Crooks, and our creator, Denise Kowalczyk. Be sure to visit kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living to find links about today's show. We are going to close out with a song by Rogue Case Royale entitled Get Loud. Thanks for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Vicki Mazzone.
Gender lines with protest signs as we're crying.